Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this week I'm going to be joined by prolific author St. Anthony.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can get.
I hope you've been enjoying the podcast of late. The bulk of the last few have been interviews, interspersed with the recent Jack Lyon one. And this podcast is a mix of an interview and a review of Celtic so far, and that's because it is an interview with author of our parish, Mr. Stephen Murray, St. Anthony as you know him, and we haven't really spoken to him much since Brendan Rodgers' revolution has happened, so we chat the Man City game. You'll recall that Saint did a preview of the Man City game with his mate, the Man City game at Celtic Park, that is, so we chat with Saint about the Man City game and then get on to the meat and bones of the podcast, which is his book Kenny of the Celtic, which covers his time as Celtic player, his formative years, and then getting onto the platform that catapulted him through to stardom as a Celtic player and then on to Liverpool. We discuss those times, we discuss the book a bit, and I ask Stephen for his perfect Celtic team of the Kenny era, if all players were available at the same time, and then the team that could have been. And if you've got any ideas listening to this of what the team could have been that you would have liked, then tweet either myself or stick on Facebook to myself or St. Anthony, or you can email in podcasts@celticunderground.net. That's podcasts@celticunderground.net. And if you want to do anything for the site, if you want to write in a piece that you want to stick up on the site, if you've got any new music, we'll still take some new music on the site, anything else, just email in podcasts@celticunderground.net. Or the email. It's also Celtic FC Foundation stuff coming up. The Celtic FC Foundation raised £75,000 for homeless with the Sleep Out recently, and we have the bucket collection prior to the 17th of December game at Celtic Park, so get your change ready for that. The Tommy Burns Supper on the 27th of January is sold out. The annual sports dinner on the 2nd of March is sold out. There will be the Abseil in Paradise. It will be in warmer climes next year, or not warmer climes, warmer climate, because it will be at the beginning of May in 2017. And there will obviously be the badge day, which will be when we get the trophy, so that will be hopefully in possibly March, April, depends when we get the trophy after we win the league, and then there'll be one or two other things. So golf day in June. That's enough of me. I will say this is me, Harry Brady, with him, St. Anthony.
Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.
Hey. So I'm joined by St. Anthony, but since he's now a professional of the literary world with his second book and no doubt starting to plan his third book, I'll give him his proper author name, Mr. Stephen Murray. How you doing, Saint?
That's a very fine introduction there, Harry, but I would love to say I was a professional, but I'm afraid not.
Oh, come off it. You're on your... Tell us, are you planning your third book?
No, and the reason why I say that is in order for me to write the books that I've done so far, it's projects that hadn't been done. So nobody done a book about the 4-2 season, and nobody done a book about Kenny's time at Celtic. So I wouldn't want to tread on anybody's toes and do something that's been done already. So it may take a wee while. I maybe think of something in the months to come.
Well, there's a competition for listeners. What we'll do is, we can talk about your book and we'll get onto that in a minute, but during the course of that book it might give people an idea as to what era of Celtic you have the strongest, fondest memories of, and the competition will be people to tweet in afterwards, or email in, and I'll give you email address, ideas for St. Anthony's next book. So before we got into the book, we're recording this. We've got the Thistle game on tomorrow night as we record this, and we've had the Man City game midweek. So, what was your thoughts on the Man City game?
The Man City game, it panned out the way I thought it was going to pan out, because they never put out a full-strength team, and we gave a good showing of ourselves against a team who, although it was under strength, still had a considerable amount of talent in it. And I think it was one of the guys on TV that mentioned that that under strength, so-called under strength Man City team, it took £92 million to put it together. So when you put it into that context, I think we did rather well. You do have to say, though, that there was nothing at stake for Man City. It would have been interesting to see how things would have panned out if maybe Man City had needed a draw and we needed a win in the circumstances to qualify. We did well. And I think it's important for us when we get down to England to give a good account of ourselves, because too many observers, quite ignorant people. I think there's a lot of guys down in England who are very articulate and know how big a club Celtic are and know that we've got a good setup here and a good team. But there is a few ignorant ones, maybe on the talk radio scene in particular, who have a condescending attitude towards anything to do with Scottish football. So I think it's important for us to give a good impression, not only for ourselves, but for the state of the Scottish game. And I think we did that in the two games against Man City, more so in the Celtic Park game, when City had a full-strength team. And those were exciting games, and I have to say, on a personal level, I quite enjoyed them both.
From the perspective of getting more points away from home in the Champions League than at home this season, I thought the game on Tuesday night was important for continuing that change of mindset within the players. Not that I'm saying these particular players had it, but patently in 29 games, Celtic players, 26 of 29 games, Celtic players have had the mindset of we're not good enough and have lost away from home.
Margin of error at this level, and when you think of Dembele missing the penalty at 1-0 in the Nou Camp. Now, I'm not saying for a minute that we would have got a result in the Nou Camp had he scored the penalty, but I do think they might have been in level at half time. It would have given us something.
Oh, absolutely, we may have gone level at half time, and the game might have finished 3-1, 4-1, which is very different to a 7-0.
Yeah, but that was my point. I don't think, given the level of talent Barca had, they would not have won in the end, but it would have made things a lot more difficult for them had we given them something to think about. So, and then the second game against Barcelona, Dembele missed a header. I'm not going to go Dembele here, by the way. I'm just pointing.
No, these are the things that happened, aye.
Yeah. So if he scores that header, that's an equaliser again at Celtic Park. You've got the crowd behind you. You never know how that might have planned it. And then you've got Callum McGregor and Mönchengladbach. Again, it's not a criticism. It's just an observation of the margins of error at this level. If he scores that goal, you know, you've got a wee win and you probably might have got above Mönchengladbach in the group in the end. You might have got the Europa League. And then you could follow that on with Tuesday night when Gary McKay-Steven and Lee Griffiths had great chances in the last 10 minutes to win the game. So it's not a criticism. It's just the fact that I think that we don't get the level of competition in Scottish football the way we get in Europe. You've definitely gone up a level in Europe. I would argue that we've gone up a couple of levels in European football. We did give a good account of ourselves, but it just goes to show how a wee bit more sharpness about the goal that might have brought us greater glory.
Well, one of my mates, someone that we both know, often makes the point that when you look at tight Champions League games, invariably, if there's only a goal separating the sides, that one goal is scored by a guy who's the most expensive player in the team. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference when you're at that level. The one chance is taken by the really top players. The other aspect, I suppose, of that Man City game, it did demonstrate the thought process that some people did have. If we could have got it to the last game, we were going to Manchester. They don't do great in Champions League football at home, and if they were through, they might have played a weakened team.
Barcelona, even if they play an under-strength team, I think they've got a wee bit more quality than Man City have got. And that's not to have a go at Man City, because, you know, the amount of money they've spent, if I would actually argue, and anybody who listens to the podcast knows that Manchester City are an English team, Man City have wasted quite a, you know, vast sums of money. I mean, some of the players they've got, they've totally paid over the odds for. And you know, a lot of them don't work out and they move on. You can take Patrick Roberts as an example, that for them to spend £12 million, which is basically chicken feed to them, then when you think that £12 million to us is basically Chris Sutton and John Harrison.
Well, although I'm led to believe they've paid £12 million, the £12 million would happen in the event that they play in a Champions League final, Patrick Robert plays and Patrick Robert scores the winner. I think I've been told that actually they've only paid about £2 million to date.
But well, that gives me hope of getting Patrick Roberts, because certainly the feedback that I'm getting to people, and I know somebody who met Patrick Roberts' mother on a flight back to London after a Celtic game, he loves it here. He's in his element. He's playing football, he's playing at a good level, he's enjoying what he's doing. He loves the club, he loves the supporters. He's really got on to being a Celtic player. And, you know, I think if we do have money for the Champions League, I would much rather do a deal with Man City to keep Patrick Roberts than buy somebody else. But I think he's a wonderful player, and he's only going to get better.
I agree. The only thing I did wonder, or I have wondered about that, is Brendan Rodgers' first choice front four, to put it that way, would be Dembele, Sinclair, Forrest, Rogic. And if Man City have paid out £2 million, knowing the English Premiership, they'll want at least £4 million for him, because that's where the English Premiership is. Would we spend £3-4 million on a guy who's not first choice?
No, I think he is good enough to progress to being first choice in the weeks and months to come. No, I think Forrest has been exceptional this season, and certainly, I have to confess that if you'd have said to me in the summer that James Forrest was leaving, I wouldn't have blinked an eyelid, because I don't think he was progressing the way that we maybe hoped. But it's ever since Rodgers has come in, whether it's the new manager, maybe it's he's fitter now, he's over his injuries, which hopefully, you know, sadly had been holding him back in the last few seasons. So you do need a squad, and you need competition. And I think one of the most impressive things about Celtic this season is, and it must really sicken the other teams in the league, is if we are not playing well, you look at the bench, and the bench is very strong. You know, any given time, you've got Griffiths, you've got Roberts, you maybe get Nir Beaton, you've got Kuo Touré. These are very, very experienced players. And they would walk into any other team in the country. In fact, they would walk into a lot of teams in the English Premiership. They're so good. So we have got a real strong squad this season. And I think that's shown through in the performances, because guys like James Forrest know they need to perform or they all get dropped. Whereas the last couple of seasons, maybe if he'd had a couple of bad games, then, you know, he just carried on. But it's really happened to see a strong Celtic squad, and to see the substitutes bench full of players who, you know, at any given time will come on and make a contribution.
Well, that's players of the present and hopefully the future, but we will get back to them. But I want to get you on to talk about your book. So obviously I trailed you as the professional author, Stephen Murray. For those who don't know, you've got a new book out, Kenny of the Celtic. So first of all, give us a general synopsis of the principle of the book.
If anybody has ever read a book about Kenny Dalglish, three quarters of the thing, the vast majority is about his time at Liverpool, which I think is fair enough because he'd outstanding success at Anfield, and he won European Cups and league titles and a wonderful era for Liverpool. But the fact is that he was 10 years at Celtic, and a lot happened during that time, and Kenny was involved in most of it. He was very, very successful. In fact, he was the best player in the UK before he joined Liverpool, and I think even Liverpool guys have acknowledged that in the past. So really it was to catalogue his Celtic career in full so that people are aware of it, because I don't think some of the younger guys out there appreciate that Kenny was, you know, although they might think that they might know that he played for Celtic, I don't think they realise what a major player he was during his time at Celtic. And there was an advert recently for the Sunday Post. You would have heard it on the radio, and it says, "Oh, Kenny Dalglish has got a column in the Sunday Post, the Liverpool and Scotland legend." And you're thinking, he was 10 years at Celtic. He was a legend at Celtic before he went to Liverpool. And yet, you get a newspaper who overlooked 10 years of his career. He only played for two teams. So that rankles with me a wee bit. So this is to redress the balance and to say that Kenny was a star long before he left Celtic. And he should be remembered fondly, more than fondly, for his contribution to Celtic during that period.
And he wasn't just a star of Celtic, he was your first Celtic hero.
The funny thing was, I was never the kind of guy who was obsessed with the individual. I always liked the team more than an individual. And although I admired guys like Jinky and Kenny Dalglish and Charlie Nicholas in later years and Paul McStay, I was never obsessed with one individual. But mostly the reason for doing the book was just to get it out there a bit, to let people know about Kenny's contribution to Celtic and make them aware of it. And there's three strands to the book. The first one is obviously it tells Kenny's story from the day that he joined Celtic to the day that he leaves for Liverpool. But the two other things that I've tried to put in the book as well is it catalogues the years between 67 and 77, which to all intents and purposes are Celtic's glory years. There's trophies galore, and there's so many important games and so much happening. For example, that there was the two semi-finals against Inter Milan and Atletico, in which Kenny played in, but which we lost in desperately close circumstances. And there was the 9-in-a-row era, which is still fondly remembered as a golden era for Celtic. He became the captain and led us to the leading cup double in 1977. So he's involved in a lot of major happenings during that period at Celtic, so it was good to get them down in print as well. And then the third thing that I've tried to put in is to give a flavour of the time in terms of the supporters. So that if anybody out there who remembers the era of the 1970s, you'll definitely enjoy the book because there's a lot of anecdotes and stories in there that relate to the 1970s and what was happening at the time. For example, one of the ones I think is one of the best ones in it is the 73 Scottish Cup semi-final against Dundee at Hampden. There was a poor guy who was arrested, 20-year-old Celtic fan, gets arrested for, and I quote, shouting and bawling in breach of the peace. And it only transpired when he went to court on a Monday morning that the poor guy was deaf and dumb and couldn't speak. And he needed a nun to come from the Little Sisters of the Poor to do sign language so that he could explain to people. So that this poor guy got arrested, allegedly for shouting and bawling and couldn't speak. So I know that it would have been a serious thing at the time, but it's a funny story to put in. And I've tried to put things like that in so that people can get a flavour of what was happening amongst the supporters at the time as well.
But it's not just, you said 60-70-77, which is a glory time for Celtic, but actually it's an odd mix that era, because it's a glory time for Celtic, but also signals the end of the glory time for Celtic.
Yeah, it does towards the end, because certainly by the time 77 comes, I made the point in the book that Kenny's departure was the signal that the great days had gone, not even a generation, only for 5 or 6 years previously, we would have enjoyed Jimmy Johnson, Bobby Lennox and Bobby Murdoch at their peak, who were amongst the best players in Europe at the time. But by the time 77 comes, the younger guys, like he and McCarry, have moved on, and some of them haven't developed as we would have hoped. Guys like Vic Davidson and John Gorman and things like that have moved away to get transfers. And Kenny is Kenny and Danny McGrain, there are two jewels in the crown. They were by far the best, two best players in Scotland. They were arguably two of the best players in the whole of the UK. And while they were there, then we had some sense of superiority and a great feeling of a feeling of joy when you go to watch them every week. But when Kenny goes, being the captain and being the talisman of the team, then I think the older Celtic fans acknowledged at that point that that was the end of it. The glory years were coming to an end. We would still have a good team, but we wouldn't have a great team. And I think that what happened in the following years backed that up.
And that's the thing, because obviously your book is focusing on Ken Dalglish, but the team that could have been that followed the Lisbon Lions, McGrain, Connolly, Hay, Dalglish, mixed in with a couple of them. It is a story for people of, I'm just a few years younger than you, so for people of my age, so I started going in 74, but so vivid memories really start. I mean, it's funny, one of my first memories of watching football on the television is actually Kenny Dalglish scoring for Liverpool in the European Cup final at Wembley.
Bruges.
Yeah, Bruges. That's one of my earliest memories of football on TV. I remember my mum called me in out of the garden to the football, European Cup final was about to start, and coming in to go and watch it. But for fans like me, looking back now, I see sort of 74 when I started going onwards as a period of what could have been. In the late 70s, or mid to late 70s, we could have had a repeat of the 60s if we'd managed to keep McCarry, Dalglish, Hay, Connolly, McGrain all in the team and brought in people of similar ability.
I think McCarry, I would make an allowance for McCarry because I think he was, I hesitate to call him a troublemaker, but I think he was a guy who had his eyes in other things. And McCarry married an American girl in the early 70s. They married very young, and he had a family very young. And I think he had a more cosmopolitan outlook because the girl was from New York, and he was never going to be a problem there. I think Lou McCarry was Italian heritage as well.
I was going to say, being a child of immigrants.
Yeah, a bit more cosmopolitan, so travelling to him was never going to be a problem. And personality-wise as well, by all accounts, I think Jock Stein in the end was quite happy to move him on. But he and Dalglish are sore ones because he definitely didn't want to go. It was a major surprise but when Celtic allowed him to go to Chelsea in 74. And the two reasons I think that Celtic could have kept Kenny looking back, there's two reasons for it. Number one is that there was a change of chairman at the time. Now, Robert Kelly had done an excellent job at keeping the Lisbon Lions happy, and he would never have counted a transfer which would weaken the team unless, in the case of Pat Crearn, when you let Pat Crearn go, it was disciplinary problems with Crearn. And I think Kelly just tired of Pat's failings and decided to make an example of him and move him on. But in terms of the Lions and the years maybe just after that, Kelly had managed to keep everybody happy, and he would never, in my opinion, would have let a Celtic player go somebody of Kenny's calibre. The other thing that Celtic were a wee bit daft about was Kenny, I think, had been teased off with Sean Fallon being demoted. Sean took the team in the 75-76 season.
Mm-hmm.
And in the summer of 76, by all accounts, Davy McParland was made Jock Stein's assistant manager at the expense of Sean. And if you believe the some of the writers of the time, Stein didn't want this, but he was forced into it because Desmond White was quite an authoritarian guy who wanted to make it clear to everybody that there was only one boss at Celtic Park, and that he was pulling the shots, and it was Jock Stein. So Kenny and Sean were very, very close.
And do you think he was able to do that because of the accident, that Steen wasn't quite as strong emotionally, yeah, physically, think, as he'd been?
Yeah, I don't think Jock was as strong mentally at that point. And I know a lot of people are a wee bit peeved in later years that he didn't make a greater stand for Sean, to try and get Sean kept on in the capacity he was. And Sean being the kind of guy he was quite happy to, I think he was hurt inside, but outwardly he was quite happy to carry on, because he was such a Celtic servant and he wanted to do his best for the club. But Kenny and David McParland didn't have a close relationship. In 1977, when Kenny's gone, I think if they still had Sean at the helm alongside Jock Steen, it would have strengthened Celtic's hands. Another thing as well is, and I make the point in the book, this was before freedom of contract. Celtic would have been quite within the rights to say to Kenny Dalglish, we know you're unhappy, but you're contracted to this club, we will not sell you under any circumstances. And he may have been unhappy, he wouldn't have been the first guy to be annoyed at not getting a transfer, but soon he would have buckled down and probably gone with things. But Desmond White, being an accountant, maybe saw an opportunity for the balance sheet. And if you really want to be cynical about it, in those days Celtic had a small shareholding, so to get big money in for Hay and Dalglish, McCarry, meant big payouts at the end of the year in the annual accounts for a very small group of shareholders, most of whom had a family shareholder.
Yeah.
Kelly's the grand successor. So that was that. And I also think as well that there was expectation that Jock Steen would find another guy, that somehow he would retain his golden touch, and that Dalglish would go. Certainly when McCarry had went, Celtic carried on regardless. And when Davy Hay went, you know, he was a big loss, but still the club had carried on to a certain extent. But when Dalglish goes, it's very much the straw that breaks the camel's back in many ways. This is a guy who only scores the goals, but he creates the vast majority of goals that Celtic have scored, and he was a huge loss when he left.
Do you think that was... to get back to your comment about no relationship with McParland, one of the things that always strikes me when you see Celtic winning trophies when Dalglish was there, was there seemed to be a close relationship between Steen and Dalglish. You know, it seemed to be one of the first players that Dalglish would, that Steen would seek out in the park to give a big hug to, would be Kenny Dalglish.
After reading Sean Fallon's book that Stephen Sullivan did, that then Sean was Kenny's first mentor at Celtic, and so much so that there's a smashing story that they've got in the book, that Ali McLeod's son got in touch to say that in 1970 Kenny was struggling to get into the Celtic team because the team was so strong at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Ali took his arm and phoned Jock Steen up to see if they would sell Kenny, and to Ali's surprise, Jock Steen never refused him outright. What Jock said was that he would leave the decision up to Sean Fallon, because Sean was in charge of the reserves and the young guy's in the reserves. So Ali gets through to Sean Fallon, and Sean said no. He said, we still think, even though he's not broke through yet, we'll be thinking in the next year or 18 months that he's going to mature and develop. And Sean was 100% right, because Kenny did physically mature and also, I think, mentally. Became a very, I think we saw that in his later years, even when he left Celtic, he was a very, very strong mental character, Kenny Dalglish. And Ali McLeod was very disappointed at that point, because he knew he was quite close to getting him. And it goes to show two things, that number one, that Sean Fallon, again, was always Kenny's biggest fan, and that he had great belief in him. And number two, you know, had he left at that point, then there's no guarantee that he would have hit the heights that he did in later years. In football, there's plenty of guys out there that either get an injury or get a bad break in terms of fate. And I think fate was kind to Kenny on a few occasions. And that's not to say that he's lucky, because
No, but I think in football there's a lot of occasions where you look at how a player's career has gone positively and negatively, when you can look back at an event, that there was a lot of luck, good or bad, that created that.
Your manager sometimes to come in and the guy that they fancy you.
Yeah.
And then you get sold to Morton or St. Murphy or something like that. And then you lose your enthusiasm and you get a wee bit demotivated and you just go through the motions. And that happens a lot in football, when, certainly when players go down a level. They tend to disappear. Very few players can go down a level and do sufficiently well to come back at the higher level. So, yeah, there's a couple of instances of Kenny being fortunate. I think the other thing he was very fortunate as well is that there was no record of teams kicking pattering Kenny's door to get him signed. And Celtic were his only option in 1967. And he may have certainly been a junior player, or he may have played in the lower leagues at a later stage. But, you know, Celtic gave him a great platform, and they gave him a great grounding as well, because the coaching at Celtic Park at that time was second to none. The guys like Steen and Sean Fallon and Willie Fernie, who were, by all accounts, were made training very enjoyable and really had great gifts for making players better and developing the players, and also training them in the Lisbon Lions. And every one of the young guys at the time, Kenny included, always owed to the fact that the Lisbon Lions were never jealous that there was a group underneath them coming through. They gladly gave their time and passed on their experience.
The other thing that always strikes me about Kenny is a lack of major injuries.
Very, very consistent player, and there's no doubt that he would have played through injury. I always remember talking to David Proven a few years ago, and David Proven said he's shocked at the players these days who have the slightest wee niggle and they sit in the stands because they can't play. He said that in our day, in order to get a decent wage, you needed the appearance money. You got a basic wage, and then you got the appearance money, and then more importantly, you get the bonus. But you only get the bonus if you were playing. So I think if you look at Celtic in that time, there were very few players who were out of long-term injury problems. And I think Bobby Murdoch's a good case in point, that he played for a number of years with a serious ankle injury, because he knew that if he wanted to earn the money that he was on and continue earning the money he was on, then he had to play in the first team.
I suppose the only thing in defence of modern players for that is with the level of fitness, it's such an exceptional level these days that that you being 10% off makes you not look very good because everybody else is so super fit. And then the other thing you would be is, how many of the players of that generation do you see now struggle to walk?
Yeah, the cortisone thing, I think, in the 60s and 70s was a horrible thing. And there was an expectation that you took this thing. And as I've alluded to there, I think a lot of players took it in the knowledge that they needed to play because they needed the appearance money in the
ball. Yeah.
That made up. So Proven certainly said that to me, that there was times that he played and he strapped himself up and basically hobbled onto the park.
And probably those were the times that supporters like you and I gave him dogs abuse for not playing well.
it's not so much that. I think that the supporters in many ways would have appreciated the efforts that the players went to play through an injury. But those guys would have went up in their estimation. Certainly, I remember one game in particular against Rangers at Celtic Park. In case anybody's wondering, it's the game that Danny Craney scored in the first minute in 1982. Celtic's forward line at the time had basically been George McCluskey, Charlie Nicholas and Frank McGarvey. And all three of them were missing that day. And it was so much of an emergency that Billy McNeil had to play Craney, who had only played a handful of games, up front alongside Tom McAdam, who he had took from centre-half and thrown into attack in an emergency basis. But I always remember after the game that Big Billy said that Danny McGrain, Davy Proven and Tommy Burns all played 90 minutes through that game when they shouldn't have played. But whether it was a knee injury or an ankle injury or what else, and he said that the three of them had offered to play through the pain barrier, whether it was taking tablets or taking an injection or you know whatever got them through it. And I always remember that, you know, he said that under normal circumstances, he says those three guys shouldn't have played, but because it's a big game against Rangers, then we really need to win it. And if it's so many guys who are injured, then those guys step forward and actually volunteer to play through the pain barrier. And you wouldn't get that now. There's no way that would happen.
The other thing about Doug Leash, and again, it's one of these things where as a child you have a slightly different perspective and understanding of things because you're not hearing, you know, you're not hearing the same type of chant, the same way. My recollection, a lot of Doug Leash, and obviously this covers the period of your book, but also the period after it, a lot of criticism in some of the Scottish press, it might not have been all of it, that Doug Leash, I remember hearing people talking about Doug Leash should be dropped from the Scotland team and how he doesn't play for Scotland the way he plays for his club sides.
Number one, I can talk from my dad's experience, and my dad said when McKenny played for Scotland, he was a step ahead of the rest of them in terms of thinking about the game. So he would be running into space looking for a pass, and it wouldn't come. Whereas at Celtic, the ball would come early because they knew which strengths were. And then there was other times that Kenny was wonderful at just flicking the ball into space for a guy to run onto. And, you know, and at Celtic at that time, you'd be guys like Dixie Deans, Harry Hood, Bobby Lennox, who would have been onto that last shot, and it would look really good. Now, when I was doing the research for the book, I came across Ali McLeod again, funny enough, an interview with Ali McLeod, and he said that he regretted in later years that playing a big guy alongside Kenny up front. And if you do remember the games for Scotland, Kenny would either play with Joe Jordan or Andy Gray, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
Eric Parry, to an extent, depending who was available at the time. And that never really suited Kenny's game, because when Kenny played for Celtic and Liverpool, he was used to playing the fast guys up front and everything done at pace. Whereas for Scotland, the tactics were two guys in the wing, slung balls into the middle, and they headed the ball down for Kenny. And he still scored an amazing amount of goals. I mean, he scored 30 goals in 102 games. And at the highest level, international level, that's good going, particularly because some of those games would have been in midfield and he wasn't always played as a striker. But the way that the system of the team at the time didn't really suit Kenny's style. And what Ali McLeod said was, he says, I wish in hindsight that I would have played a Lou McCarry up front or a Joe Harper, somebody smaller and quicker and more nimble that suited Kenny's style. And I think that was part of the reason why he suffered for Scotland, because he was playing the big lumbering guys up front that he never ever played with Celtic or Liverpool.
So you touched on formation and system there. A Kenny Doug Leash of that sort of 74 to 77 period in particular, in the modern football system of 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3, whichever way you want to put it, but pretty much that set up, where do you think Kenny would have played?
In the modern game?
In the modern, so look at the modern Celtic team. Would he be Dembele, Rogic, Forrester, Sinclair? What position on the park would he be?
Because Kenny at his best always played up front with another striker and a two up front, which would have been your bog standard 4-4-2. And I know we don't tend to play that these days. Now, the reason I say that is his best strike partner at Celtic was Dixie Deans.
Mm-hmm.
Very successful period of the two of them playing together. And then when you look at Liverpool, it was exceptional when Doug Leash and Rush played together.
Yep.
Because they complemented each other so well, you know, Kenny's style of taking the ball and shielding it and laying balls into space. And Rush basically just had to run into the space and the ball would arrive for him. So if we take that out of the equation, then he was very good at Celtic in many seasons, playing what I would call the number 10 role these days.
Well, just when you were describing there his partnership with Rush, that's exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Would he be suited to that number 10?
Yeah. I would tend not to play him wide right or wide left. I would have had him certainly behind, but coming through behind the striker, and he was really good at that. He was wonderful at running with the ball from deep, from midfield and attacking the defence. And he could slide great passes through. It was a wonderful pass playable, really. And he was also a great guy for, he was a delight to watch in terms of his flicks and feints and dummies. Because again, he was one step ahead in his head, and he knew what he wanted to do. and the Celtic players could read that because they played alongside him in training, and they knew what he was going to do. Whereas, as we were seeing there about Scotland, he would try these things and he would probably look a wee bit daft when they didn't come off, because the rest of the Scotland players weren't used to his style of play.
So, your book covers, and if people listening to this, there'll be links on various places as to where you can get the book. I was in the Celtic shop on Argyle Street this week, and your book was there, Pride of Place. So people can go into the Celtic shop and get your book, and they can go online, and we'll give people links as to what how to get it online. If they look. But I've got two questions that I've not primed you for, so I'm going to catch you to see if I can get you on the hop for it. One of which is, Doug Leash was at Celtic from 67 to 77, but was really a first-team player from sort of early 70, 71 through to 77. What would be your perfect Celtic 11 if you could choose anybody? If we go from 70 to 77, what would be your ideal Celtic starting 11 from that period?
From any player that played in that
game? Any Celtic player who played 70 to 77. And what I'm trying to do is discount picking the Lisbon Lions, right?
Yeah, I would say the goalkeeper's always a hard one because we never really had an exceptional keeper.
Now remember, we have a goalkeeper listening to this podcast, so you got to be careful. He's got big hands. You've interviewed him, and he'll come round and give you a doing.
77, I would go for. I think there was a period that Ali Hunter played just after he joined Celtic. That they were making comparisons between him and Ronnie Simpson, and we always talk about fate being a funny thing. Well, fate was a bad thing for Ali because he lost a goal against Czechoslovakia, and for whatever reason, he was never the same against that. He was never the same again. After that,
you know the game. I have the vaguest recollections of Ali Hunter playing in a game when he'd not played in the team for a while against Dundee United.
Is that when he let a goal in the first minute
and then they scored almost again, and it was virtually through his legs, but fortunately it was offside.
That was the last game that he played. That was early 76, and after that he was moved on. Peter Latchford had came by that time. So I would go for Ali at his best, because it was a period 73, 74, he was really a wonderful keeper. In the full-back positions, I would go for Danny at right-back, an obvious one, and at left-back I would go for Davy Hay. Centre-backs, again, I think it's quite easy. Big Billy at his best, alongside George Connolly. If you play a 4-3-3, which was popular at the time, the three-man midfield would be Bobby Murdoch in the centre, certainly. I would go for Stevie Murray on the right hand side, and on the left hand side I'd be tempted to put Tommy Callaghan, and then up front it would be Jinky, Dixie Deans and Kenny Dalglish.
Okay, so anybody listening, they can tweet you with their alternative opinions to that. And then the other big test that I'm going to ask you is pretty much Kenny's if Kenny had stayed at Celtic, he obviously played through to 87.
Yeah.
If Kenny had stayed at Celtic, what would be your perfect Celtic team, seven out of people who played 77 to 87? Do you know, as we're doing this, and just before you do it, because obviously that's an year I remember, you're about to name players that makes me upset in some ways, that Celtic didn't do better in European football during that period because we had the players.
I know. I think the looking back, there's no doubt that we were tactically naive in Europe because we still believed that we could attack at home at will and get leads to take to away games, and it didn't always work like that because sometimes a team would hit it in the break, and you saw it even in the Scottish game by that time. Aberdeen and Dundee United came and played in a very European style at Celtic Park. They would sit in, defend for the first 20-25 minutes, soak up everything, and then hit it in the break, and sure enough, we would lose maybe the first goal, and the place would die, the atmosphere would go down, and so I don't think we learned how to play against that type of team.
I remember, and during that era as well, teams were becoming more sophisticated on tactics and systems, and people were starting to get an understanding of, we might not be as good as that team, but if we can be better organised, we can match them. And I remember hearing an interview with Murd McLeod talking about Billy McNeil as a manager and his certain style. I remember him saying, just as you're talking there, it's just reminded me of him saying that he felt Celtic had the players to get to European finals and semi-finals during the early to mid-80s. But never once in a European game did Billy McNeil tell them anything about the opposition. Because Billy McNeil's attitude was, we're Celtic and we don't need to bother about them. If we play to our game, we're good enough.
That's my point about being tactically naive. I don't think we move with the times, shall I say, because part of the reason Kenny left was, and again I make this point in the book, is by 1977 we were going out in European football to the likes of Olympiakos, Wisla Krakow, and a team called Sachsenring-Zwickau from East Germany, who totally disappeared in later years. So, you know, he's looking at that and he's thinking, you know, I still want to be playing in European semi-finals and finals. And if it's not happening here, then maybe I'd be better going somewhere where that is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And you can never doubt his choice of club when he went to Liverpool, because they did all these things. He won three European Cup medals.
Yep.
He played at the highest level, and he was Liverpool's best player, let's be blunt. And I don't hold a grudge against him for leaving in 77 if he was solely looking at our European pedigree for those two or three seasons. But the irony is, by 77 we did have a better team. We had won the league, and we were very optimistic about getting to Europe that season, and sadly it wasn't to be, because Kenny left, and there was a whole number of injuries and unfortunate incidents that happened that made that season particularly painful.
So, if I say from the day he left to 87, so you pretty much got two goalkeepers to choose from, Latchford or Bonner, and then I'll leave the rest to you. I suppose you could Roy Baines, you could chuck in.
I'm including Dalglish in this.
And Dalglish is in the team. So, if Dalglish had stayed, what would have been the optimum team we could have had?
Back Danny, the centre backs would have been Big Roy, obviously, and it would probably need to be Tom McAdam for consistency. I think Tom's quite underrated. At left back, Mark Reid. Three-man midfield.
Well, don't forget, you could, if we're going right up to 87, do we catch Mick McCarthy and the like? Right, we'll leave him out. Right, okay, he's out.
78, so that's a wee bit later. Three-man midfield, it's quite an easy one. It would have been McStay, McLeod and Burns for the balance. That was a wonderful midfield. The three of them complemented each other superbly. And then if you're looking at the forward line, it would be Davy Proven in the right wing, Kenny, and this is a hard one because you have Charlie Nicholas, Brian McClair, Frank McGarvey, George McCluskey, all of whom I loved completely. But I think at his best, I'm going to give it to McClair, and the reason why I give it to McClair was I think he was a more hardy soul than Nicholas. I think Charlie was the more skillful player, but I think Brian McClair, in terms of consistency and scoring goals, and I think he would have complimented Kenny better.
You don't think Nicholas would have been closer to Rush in style?
No.
And McClair closer to Dalglish in style?
Yeah, Nicholas and Dalglish were probably more similar in terms of very technical players. And they could do something that would get the crowd on their feet. Just by dropping a shoulder or a wee twist or a turn, you know, that brilliantly talented players. But I think McClair, for me, during that era, pound for pound was the best finisher. So play was he wasn't as technical as Nicholas. I wouldn't claim for a minute that Brian McClair as a footballer was remotely close to Charlie. But what Brian McClair did have it was clinical finishing. He could get in the end of things. You know, if you threw a ball into the penalty area and Brian McClair attacked it, then I think maybe like 6 times out of 10 McClair would get in the end of it. Because he just had that knack, a superb knack for getting the end of things. So I just would edge McClair in front of Nicholas.
Who did you say you'd have at left back?
Matt Reid.
Matt Reid, of course.
A very underrated guy, steady player.
What have you got against Peter Lashford? Peter Lashford wasn't in your 70s team and Peter Lashford wasn't in your 70s to 80s.
It sounds a bit rough, Peter Lashford, and I'm a big fan. I think he was a wonderful character. But I think Hunter, for a period, was more consistent. And I think Bonner hit the heights a wee bit better than Lashford. Although Bonner, I think if he'd done Achilles heel, there was many, many games at Ibrox, I think that, for want of a better expression, his bottle crashed.
Do you know, it's one of these things when you're seeing concentrated goal clips and stuff like that, whenever you see goal clips of the old Rangers scoring against us in that era, it always seems to be with Pat Bonner in completely the wrong position, diving for a cross and somebody nipping in front of him. It always seems to be nowhere.
He was never the greatest across his path, which is strange because he was a very good Gaelic Games player, and that's a big strength in that competition, that you need to be able to catch the ball in midair. So that seemed a bit strange to say that.
So that's your 77, that's the could have been team.
The could have been team. And again, it's all sort of hearsay because in a perfect world, we would have kept them all together and they would have been happy and we would have went on to great things, but it wasn't to be.
No, if we had a team like that, who'd have known what would have happened with the Rangers situation and all those things. So that's your book, and as I say, we'll put online how people can get it. If you can get to a Celtic shop, you'll get it in the Celtic shop. So we touched on the Man City game. So how are you enjoying football under Brendan Rodgers?
Wonderful. I am so happy. Happy for a whole number of reasons. Happy for the the main thing is that I feel as if I am now being entertained when I go and see Celtic play, and that's a great feeling. Great feeling. And that includes win, lose and a draw. You know, I know that we didn't qualify in Europe, but we gave it a good go and we gave a good account of ourselves. I also noticed that after the game on Saturday, Eddie Pearson had put something on Twitter, which I really agree with, when he said that Celtic team, the way they played and their fighting spirit to the death, is something that we were reared on as boys, and it's great to see it that it's still there, because you know we're renowned for fighting spirit, and it's good to have skillful players, and it's good to play attractive football, but you know that heart that the team showed at the weekend there, the never say die spirit, is something that delights me, and it proves as well that not only are we a good team, then we still have the old Celtic fighting spirit as well. Which is great to see.
It shows to me that they believe in themselves and they believe in their colleagues, they believe in their teammates, because that's how you keep going as a person, because you believe your teammates going to keep going.
Yeah, the other thing is, well, I know we kind of want a wee bit in things in terms of people to O'Malley and Scott Brown epitomises the fighting spirit that the team has at the moment. You know, he's very, very much the leader, and he has played some tremendous football this season. And in many ways, he has performed at a level higher than I thought he was capable of, to be honest. And I think it shows where you get better players round about you, that it brings out the best in some players. You know, when you see Dembele playing and you see Sinclair, and guys are reborn like Tom Rogic and James Forrest, then Scott Brown has responded to that, and he is having a wonderful season. The thing that makes me really happy is I take my son to the games and he's 12, and there's been 5 games this season that I think he'll remember for the rest of his days in terms of the entertainment and the excitement. The first one was the BFC game, the 5-2 game at Celtic Park. it was such a roller coaster of emotions, you know, we're seeing nothing up. We feel as if we're going through, and then it gets to 3-2, and you're devastated. I know that, I was devastated, and I thought the team showed wonderful resilience to come back and score twice again to get to 5-2. That was a great night. The second one, obviously, is the 5-1 game against Rangers. That he'd never seen a Celtic Rangers game at Celtic Park before. That was his first, and he was thrilled to bits. Then it was the Man City game in the Champions League, which was another roller coaster of emotions. You know, like three times we took the lead, three times they come back. But man, what a game to be involved in. Then there was a last minute goal that Bailey scored in the semi final against Rangers, and then there was a League Cup final against Aberdeen, which the team played to form and won very comprehensively. And you know, given our record at Hampden in the last couple of years, that was very, very welcome.
Although as we were going to the game, and I was saying, oh, the only thing that I'm not sure about is our record at Hampden, to which my brother proceeded to point out that Aberdeen's record at Hampden was worse than ours. So that did make me, they played to their Hampden record.
They did. So that's five games in total that he has saw since late July, and he is exhilarated. You know, you can see it in his face. And the other thing as well I want to mention is it's wonderful to go back to Celtic Park with big crowds and a great atmosphere, and we've got the standing section at the moment, which is terrific at getting the crowd going, and you can just tell that everybody is enjoying the football again, and that's all done to Brendan Rodgers. There's no doubt about it, but he has been the catalyst that's changed the whole club from top to bottom. And I think we're very fortunate to have Brendan Rodgers as manager.
Although, to be fair to Rangers, they have played their part in being a catalyst in bringing Brendan Rodgers, because it's only because they got bigots on their board that incentivised Dermot Desmond to say, I'm not having people like that getting one over me, and decided to loosen the bank balance a wee bit. So we do have to give some thanks to the Rangers for employing bigots on their boards. For helping us to get to this as well.
I don't know if you saw that. I put a photo on Twitter after the Aberdeen final, and it was a photo came across online, and it was Dermot Desmond speaking to Ian Bankier, and Ian Bankier obviously is totally paying attention because Dermot Desmond's speaking, and the wee caption that I put at the bottom was, "Hey Ian, do you remember the Rockets in April and how they behaved? They're no laughing now."
I saw that.
You know, that's the point you're making, that had that not happened, then Brendan may or may not be here. There's a good chance he wouldn't have been here, but again, fate's a funny thing, and this occasion, fate's been very kind.
Well, hopefully he goes on to see a few more memorable things. Hopefully he gets to see Celtic's first treble. We're two-thirds of the way there.
That would be great.
And hopefully next season he'll get to see us play minimum last 16 Champions League football. And I don't know if you've done the working out that I've done yet. We play Rangers on the 11th of March at Celtic Park. That could be a really... We need to lose quite a few games for that not to be very close to the game that we win the league. I don't know what the football authorities should do, because you know how we're not allowed to play Rangers in a game that involves winning the league?
Certainly in a decider. Now, the earliest I can remember us winning the league off the top of my head is March 1970, 20th of March. And in recent times, I think we won it in the first week of April with Gordon Strachan was there. We beat Hearts 1-0 at Parkhead. So that was early. So if we were to win it in March the 11th, that would be tremendously early to win a league title in any league at any time.
And it may seem a bit unreasonable, but when you look at the league table, we've only played five home games. So I know we've got all these games together, and playing Saturday, Tuesday is that's when you're going to drop points, just playing that amount of football. But we've got this run of games. We were playing the likes of Hamilton and Thistle. We are got a disproportionate number of home games coming up. And in that run of games, in the next wee while, we are playing Hearts, Aberdeen, and Hearts at Celtic Park, Aberdeen at Celtic Park, and the Rangers away. Taking points off them, if we could easily be on, at the current rate, we could be on there or thereabouts of mid to high 80s points by the time we get to the 11th of March.
I don't know if you remember the 2003-04 season. I was a wee bit annoyed because I think we created a record that season. I think we made 31 games unbeaten out of 38. It may have been more than that, actually. Maybe 32 or 33. And the reason why it annoyed me was we could, to all intents and should have, to all intents and purposes, went through the season unbeaten. And the only two games that we didn't win were Aberdeen at home and Dunfermline at home after the league was won. And the main reason for that was that Martin O'Neill, who was the manager at the time, rested a lot of players in both games because the cup final against Dunfermline was coming up. And I don't think for a minute that either Dunfermline or Aberdeen would have beaten us had we put a full-strength team out. And it sort of rankled with me at the time because it would have been a tremendous feat to go through a full league season unbeaten. I think obviously Arsenal stole our thunder a wee bit, running at the same time by doing it down in England for a full season, which is a tremendous achievement. But we could have done that also, and it rankles with me a wee bit that O'Neill didn't put more into those games only because that there was a record to be won. But then again, O'Neill was a very pragmatic guy. He would have saw the Scottish Cup being a far bigger attraction than some record that may be broken at a later date by somebody else or something like that. So I think that's a possibility this season that we could go through unbeaten. But these things, you know, even when you see Barcelona and Bayern Munich going in great runs, it tends to come to an end against the team you least expect.
Yeah, I mean, that was the situation on Saturday when we were 2-0 down to Motherwell, and I was thinking, do you know, as you just say, it's actually the games that you least expect. It's when the players mentally are not at it. The players you're playing against mentally are at the top of their game. All things conspire. That's, you know, a lucky couple of lucky goals. But you're right, it was season 2003-04. I remember it. I remember being really disappointed walking out of Celtic Park and we'd lost to Aberdeen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. And
I don't remember who scored it, but I know it was a late one. And I'll tell you the reason why I should be forgetting that game. My son was born during that night, after that game. And I didn't go to the game, obviously, because his arms was in labour and that kind of thing. And I remember being in the hospital and somebody told me the score and I burst out laughing because that was the record up on the slates, because, you know, people were making a big thing about Celtic's first defeat of the season, and it didn't come to Michael was born on April 22nd, so that would have been April 21st. So that's why it sticks in my mind that they lost that game.
And just as you're on, Celtic's 77 game unbeaten home record was brought to an end by a late goal from Don striker David. I have no recollection of this guy.
Well, was that the Australian guy there?
Zdrilic?
Zdrilic.
Mm-hmm. Brian Prunty levelled the scoring for Aberdeen. I didn't know Brian Prunty had been. And then they scored the winner in the 90th minute.
So
we've got a game on Friday night, as we record this, tomorrow night, against Partick Thistle. What's your expectation of the team, and what's your expectation of the score?
Well, firstly, I'm so glad it's a Friday night, because we've got tickets to go, me and Junior, and we don't get too many away games these days, because he plays on a Saturday, and it's a lot of Celtic's away games are at lunchtime. There's no way we can make it, so that's a big frustration for us. So Friday night games, I'm all for it. I think it creates a good atmosphere on a Friday night. I think the fans like it better, because you've still got the whole weekend in front of you. I think sometimes when you have a game on a Sunday, there's a psychological thing in the back of your mind that, you know, you've got work tomorrow, you maybe don't want to go to the pub, it's not ideal. But a Friday night is great, because obviously most people don't have work on a Saturday, and you can go and enjoy your night. I think it's a good thing for football in this country. So we'll be looking forward to that. How is it going to turn out? I'm hoping it's going to turn out well again for Celtic. I think we're definitely creating chances. We're very much a team who look as if we're going to score goals every game we play. In terms of the team, I think it'll be along the usual lines. And I think one of the great strengths of Celtic teams who do well is that you know basically who 9 or 10 of the players are going to be. I think that part of the problem with Ronnie towards the end was there was so much shuffling of the team and chopping and changing going on. I don't think that was doing any good for his side at the time. But that's just that's just a wee criticism. Obviously, Craig Gordon in goals, I think Lustig will be right back. I think we'll continue with Shevchenko and Simunovic in centre defence. And it does have to be said that if he can keep those two guys fit and keep them together, they look like terrific defenders. You know, that they complement each other, that they're strong, they're good in the air, that they're good passers as well. They're ideal modern defenders for football. They're tremendous players. And I only hope that we keep the two of them for many years to come. Left back, Emilio will probably come back in there. The two in midfield, Brown and Armstrong are playing terrifically well at the moment. You know, Armstrong just looks a totally different player. He is beginning to mature into the player that we all hoped that he would be.
Yep.
When we signed him to Dundee United. And then you've got the three guys in behind the striker. I presume that maybe Forrest and Sinclair are still injured, so that would maybe leave a wee space for maybe Griffiths to come in on the right hand side.
You don't think you play Mackay Stephen?
I think Brendan would play Mackay Stephen, but me personally, I think I'd like to give Griffiths a run. I think he's been quite patient in getting back into the side, and I think he needs a game for his sharpness. So I'm tempted to play Griffiths in the right of the three, cutting in on his left foot. That can't be right, because Patrick Roberts is there. So Patrick Roberts would be in the right, and then Rogic in the middle, Griffiths on the left, supporting Dembele up front.
You wouldn't play Mackay Stephen and rest Dembele and play Griffiths up front?
Do that personally at the moment. I would try and keep the strongest team as possible, because you don't have any European football now. Although we do have a few.
We do have a game again on Tuesday night.
You've got a game for the next couple of midweeks.
Aye, yep.
But yeah, I know what you're getting at. He may want to use his squad to the full. So that's the team I would pick. And there's plenty of goals in that team. So there is I would think that's quite an exciting team.
Okay, and your prediction for the score?
I would hope for Celtic to win by 2 goals, whether it's 2-0 or 3-1.
2-0 or 3-1, okay. And one final thing, you've still not come up with what your next book's going to be about. What about the next book being what could have been? A book about what Celtic could have been if they'd not sold people from Kendal Glesier or onwards.
The one thing that's crossed my mind, and it's not going to happen for years, even if I did have the inclination to do it, which I have to say, after having written 2 books in the last couple of years, I think I'll have a wee rest, but The one thing that spring to mind now that you mentioned it is the team that Billy McNeil put together in by 1983. Well, it was a tremendous team. You know, you had Nicholas McStay, Pat Bonner, Roy Aitken, Tommy Burns, Davy Proven, an exceptional team. And within a couple of weeks in 1983, it was decimated because Nicholas left, George McCluskey left, and Billy McNeil went to Manchester City. And looking back on it, I would say that's one of my biggest disappointments as a Celtic fan, because had that team kept together, and you might have said, you know, Brian McBear came that summer, so he would have strengthened it even further by having McBear there, then that team should really have done a whole lot better. And again, fate's a funny thing, because fate wasn't kind to us in terms of injuries at the time, and Aberdeen and Dundee United enjoyed tremendous success, and I still, and this is going to sound bitter, think that Celtic team were the better, if equal if not the better of anything that Aberdeen and Dundee United could put in the pitch. But again, you know, fate's a funny thing, as I keep on saying, and we'd be tremendous bad luck at that period in many ways. But then again, we were still in the habit of selling the best players, whereas Aberdeen managed to keep Gordon Strachan for long enough, and they kept Willie Miller. And you look at Dundee United keeping David Neary and Paul Sturrock for so long, you wonder why they could keep their players and Celtic have to keep selling their best players. So the answer is obviously at board level. And I think sometimes we give our board of directors a hard time, but when you think that we kept Henrik Larsson for 7 years in the FPL, at the seven best years of his career, I often think that our board get a raw deal when they do fairly well in terms of signing players and keeping players and as long as they can in a poor league.
Well, on that shock news of St Anthony praising the Celtic board, I will say Stephen Murray, St Anthony prolific author, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me again, Harry, pleasure.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that podcast with St Anthony covering past, present and future Celtic teams and Celtic stars. You can get the book online, as mentioned. There's plenty of online places. Obviously, go to Amazon, it's a very popular bit. And it's, I can see it just now, £10 in Amazon bookstore. And you can also go into any Celtic shop and pick it up. And it's Kenny of the Celtic by Stephen Murray, and it's published by Celtic Quick News Books. That's enough of me. There'll be more podcasts along shortly with some excellent more guests, more Celtic chat, and some fantastic more Celtic games to go and watch, and who knows what the future will bring for us and the signings that we'll bring along. I hope you enjoy your Christmas shopping, hope you enjoy the Thistle game, and this is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless. Goodnight.